We just finished decorating the Christmas tree. And that's where I was when I heard him rush down the hall and out the front door. I knocked him, and he stopped, and he looked right at me. And he turned and walked away.
For Kathleen, Christmas only held unwanted memories.
It really isn't so bad.
They called me a gourmet Grinch.
There's just no Christmas cheer in here.
I hope you liked what I picked.
What is that?
Lucy, that's enough.
The child is unbelievable.
What's wrong with you?
So...
what?
So not Mom.
Oh, all like crazy.
What happened to the babysitter?
I'm only going to be gone for one night.
Do you have any more safety pins?
No.
I'll have to pick some up.
I'm 10 years old. I'm not a child. I'll be fine. You can go without me.
Until she met a man.
Did you lose something?
Who would change her life.
My day when a lady asked you to leave her alone, you left her alone.
How about you mind your own business?
I'm making it my business.
You better come with me.
You didn't mention you had a daughter.
Oh, no, I don't have a daughter. I hardly know her.
Last night's cold front was an ice and snowstorm.
Sometimes the best gifts in life come from the most unexpected places. Catherine Mary Stewart, Muse Watson, Anthony Tyler Quinn, and introducing Cameron Tenable.
What about your mother?
I wouldn't know what to say to her. I haven't spoken to her in years.
You'll never know unless you try.
The time has come for you to stand again. The time has come.
A Christmas Snow.
You're listening to the Exploration Films Podcast. Stories of consequence. A deep dive into films from around the world. Conversations with producers, directors, and actors, where they discuss the behind-the-scenes stories of filmmaking and also reflect on their motivations and their worldview as storytellers.
Welcome to the Exploration Films Podcast. I'm your producer and host, Steve Ryder. Today's film we're featuring is A Christmas Snow by Tracy Trost. Tracy, you may remember, was interviewed last season for his film, The Lamp. And because we are in the thick of the holiday season, we wanted to talk about one of our top performing films on Amazon Prime, A Christmas Snow. This film is about a woman that refuses to celebrate Christmas because her father walked out on them during the holiday when she was a child. But a weekend snowed in with a chivalrous older stranger and her boyfriend's daughter start to soften that hard heart. Tracy and I also picked up where he and Carl left off talking about the neuroscience of changing your mind. Here's my interview with Tracy Trost. Tracy, thanks for being on the Exploration Podcast again.
Hey, I'm glad I made the cut to make season two. Congratulations on that.
Well, considering that A Christmas Snow... it was one of Exploration Film's top films in terms of views, et cetera, in 2018. I mean, it crushed records within the company that holiday season. We needed to have you on. Plus, on the last one, we talked about how your work with neuroscience and how you've crafted these spots for these nonprofits that you work for, and how that's changed you as a filmmaker. That totally was something that when you and Carl talked about it last time, I, as the producer sitting next to Carl, was like, I want to hear more about that.
Yeah, so, yeah. It's interesting because if you are a storyteller, there's a reason you're telling a story. And hopefully at least for me, I can speak to my reasonings. Is that, you know, I want to tell a story that somehow will get somebody to think of something in a way that they haven't thought of it before. And if you come at it just from, hey, let me tell you a colorful story, that's one thing. But if I come at it also understanding why and how people respond to things, and what are specific items you can incorporate in your storytelling that would cause people to connect to your story. I think it's a little bit of the secret sauce then, that having an understanding of the neuroscience and understanding of why people, I'm not going to say respond, I'm going to say why people trigger to a story being told. Then it just helps you make your content something that can then be very, very meaningful, carry a message, and hopefully affect and change lives.
What's the difference? But why did you use the word trigger and not respond?
Well, because one thing you need to understand is 95% of the things you do and say and have happened in your life, you've happened due to the conditioning and decisions you've made before you were 7 years old. And these are, it's like, if you think of a computer hard drive, these are files that have been written on your hard drive. And as an adult, you go back, you experience something and you say, what do I believe about this? And then your 7-year-old child says, you believe this, and you have a positive or negative reaction to that. And there's a handful of things that we as, and I'm going to say we as people who live in the US in this day and age, and, you know, growing up from the 60s up till now, because that's usually where my 50s, 60s are my audience for the nonprofits. There are commonalities and general things that people will all respond to. Again, not knowing why you responded, but you will respond.
Mm.
It's interesting. So it's more of a trigger. It's more of a reaction, because you think as a person walking around that your life is by choice, and it really isn't. Your life is a result of what you believe about things. And these beliefs, again, were mostly formed by the age of 7. So most adults walking around today have the belief system of whatever they were given by parents, by environment, by community, up to about 7 years old, and you form opinion based on that. So you have things that happen, which you can think you're saying, well, I don't like that. That makes me angry. And you feel like you're choosing to be angry, but actually you're responding or happy or sad or whatever the response is. And it's a trigger more than it is a choice.
Now, did you have that knowledge when you wrote A Christmas Note?
Because no.
The weird thing is,
I would approach it differently if I did.
Really? How so?
That's a good question. It's when I wrote, so let's get back to kind of the origins of Christmas Snow and why.
Yeah.
I was playing golf with a friend of mine one day, and I said, I'm kicking this idea around about a story. And I said, I don't even know where it came from, but the idea was, if you passed away and you go to heaven and God says to you, I'm going to give you 5 days to go back to earth and fix whatever you want to fix, what would that thing be that you would go back to do? And what people don't realize when they watch A Christmas Snow, there's a lot of subliminal messaging in there, actually, if I think about it. Maybe I was always bent this way. I'm going to speak about, so let's do this. Spoiler alerts, okay? If you haven't seen the film, I would recommend go watch the movie and then come back and listen to this, because I'm going to speak to it as if we've already seen it and we're familiar, okay? Right? So when Sam appears to Kathleen, she sees him as this, you know, old man. Again, remember, she's got daddy issues because of what happened to her with her kid, which a lot of people I meet have issues with their parents, and many times women with their fathers. And I think that's why that might have been something that's kind of near and dear to my heart, because my wife had, not that her parents were bad, but she had issues with her father, the father figure in her life. Mm-hmm. And so it's familiar to me, right? And I thought, mm-hmm. Boy, if something could happen that would help my wife heal, that'd be great, right? So the approach was to say then, Sam has passed away and Sam comes back. He just appears, right? All of a sudden in front of Kathleen. And he has a secret mission that he's working on. She doesn't realize it because she doesn't recognize him. And I think part of that is, if you want to call it supernatural interference or something, she doesn't recognize who he is until the end of the film. But his goal, and most people think his goal is to get him to forgive her. And that isn't what his goal was. His goal was to connect her back to her mother. Mm. And so he leads her when you come back home. And he's like, okay, I jacked up my life. I jacked up her life. But I've got one thing I can fix, would be reconnecting her back to her mother and let there be forgiveness between her and her mother. Mm. Well, at the same time, there was forgiveness between her and him.
Yeah.
Because that happens through osmosis, basically, or through the relationship. But her, at the end of the movie, she goes home, of course, and you've seen it. And she reconciles with her mom. She's willing to forgive her mother at that point because she blamed her mom for everything. It was your fault dad left. It's your fault this, you know, which happens a lot when she's a young child. When a parent leaves, they want to assign blame. And many times the sad part is they assign the blame to themselves. What did I do? I did something wrong, you know?
Yeah.
And so for Kathleen's sake, or in her instance, she was blaming. And that's why she could never have any good relationships with men later on in life, because there was always that you're going to abandon me thing, that trigger in the back of her brain based on the conditioning she had. So I guess, you know what? I changed my mind. I did have that stuff back then. I guess I didn't realize it.
Yeah, you know? I thought that because in large part, I mean, Kathleen emotionally felt like she was stuck at 10 years old in the way in which she would interact with Lucy.
Mm-hmm. Who was a 10-year-old girl at the time.
Yeah.
And the reason we did that is kind of like pulling her back to somebody who was just like her, in the same kind of situation. Lucy doesn't have a mom. She's got a dad, and she's acting out the same way. And her defense mechanism is to be kind of a little brat and to sabotage the relationship between dad and her, you know, because she didn't want a new mom, right? You know, it's all stuff that you run into with children. So it's an interesting dynamic. And there's a book that goes along with the movie. It's called Restored. And that book, again, you need to read that book after you watch the movie, because that book is Sam's journey through life and his letters to his daughter that he wrote after he left her as a child and the experiences he had up to the moment all of a sudden he was there with her and didn't even realize what was going on. So in the movie, he's like, she'll come in the room and he's sitting there writing in a book. Well, that book is Restored and he talks. So when you watch the movie, then you get to hear basically his thoughts. There's different scenes in the movie that they have things happen, and there's thoughts that he writes down and lessons that he tries to give to her after he's left.
Wow.
My final gifts for Katie, the gift of faith, that you would have a love for God in your heart, the gift of friendship, that you would learn to love others deeply, the gift of peace, that you would enjoy life to its fullest and have a heart filled with peace. The gift of family, that you would embrace family no matter the circumstance. And most of all, the gift of forgiveness, that you would discover the healing and restoring power of forgiveness.
She finds that book at, you know, this notebook that he had.
Yeah.
It's crazy. So, yeah, a lot of fun. So that's where it came from. It came from the conversation with a friend. And it was really more like, if you could go back and fix something in your life that you jacked up, what would it be? You know, and then it evolved to, well, what if God sent you back? And what if there was like a little bit of supernaturalness to it? You know, because I had a lot of people asking me, you know, is he an angel? Is he an apparition? Is he alive? You know, and I never really answered those questions. My reaction was mostly, well, what do you think he is? And whatever helps you embrace the story is then what he is, you know, and people don't usually like that answer. Because then I got into the, you know, well, does God send people back as angels? I'm like, I don't know. That's not the point. It's metaphorical. You know, it's like, was there actually a Samaritan on a road when Jesus talked about that? He says there was a man walking on a road and he came across somebody who had been beaten up and they call him the Good Samaritan.
Yeah.
Jesus was just telling stories. There probably wasn't really a Samaritan. There wasn't really a guy beat up. Now he tells a story about a farmer. There was a farmer who was planting seeds and he put some in shallow ground and some in good ground. You know, okay, was there really a farmer? No, he was just telling stories that people who were with him could connect to.
Yeah.
And they were relatable stories and they could identify themselves. They could mirror themselves doing these things. So then they had value to them. And then you could remember that story. I mean, it's easier to remember the story than it is just to, you know, remember a lesson. Jesus just could say, hey, don't invest your time and money in things that won't bring a return. Okay, great. Or I could tell a story about a farmer planting seeds because I can relate to that. So that's all Christmas snow is. That's really all any entertainment is, the stories, you know. And everyone has a message. Yeah. They always say they don't, but they all do.
What was it like making this film? Because it was early in your film career.
Yeah. It was eye-opening. I had a friend, his name is David Campbell, give him a little shout out. And in 2006-ish, I was like, you know, I've done television, I've done live broadcasts, I've done concerts, I've done talk shows, I've, you know, shot all over the world, I've done documentaries. So I have this drive or this desire to do narrative, to tell stories. And he was like, well, let's do it. I'm like, buddy, I don't know what to do. I've never done that before, you know? And yeah, he's like, you know what? We know, you know, people who have, right? So we started making connections with people who had done it. And it was like, well, let's just do this thing. So that was a movie called Find Me. And
what out of those connections did you glean? I mean, what were you looking for?
That was it.
And what did you get?
I mean, everything, you know, because I'd never done that. It's funny. So I'm on set one of the first days, and I have a friend, his name is Jason Stafford, and he was my assistant director, and he had done films and he'd done a bunch of stuff. And he was one of the guys, I'm like, can you help me? And he came in, and I'm watching a performance by my actors, and I'm kind of making a scrunchy face like, I'm not digging it, you know? And he looks at me, he goes, what's the matter? I go, I just don't like the performance. And he goes, well, say cut. I'm like, I can do that? He's like, you can say whatever you want to say. You're the director. I'm like, all right, cut, you know? So I didn't even know I could say cut. I didn't even know I could say action. You know, I didn't know anything. I mean, it was that green, you know? And so he would call action for me. And he's like, if you want to say action, you can say it. I'm like, oh, okay, I can do it. All right. And action, you know? So it's funny because writing the first script really made me face my insecurities, you know, in storytelling and formulating a story.
How so?
Well, it's always been something that was natural to me, but to put it in paper, first you have to learn how a script is written and the style and the formatting, because there's things that are acceptable and aren't in writing a script. But when you're laying that out there on a script and you're handing it to people to read and they're going to give you their opinion, you know, you're laying out a piece of your flesh and blood there, yeah, you know, and it's very, for me, and yeah, it was a very insecure time because I would take their criticism personally, like it was a personal cut on me, you know, and I had to learn everybody's got opinions. If you can get half the people to like what you're doing good, and not everybody's going to like or even see what you're doing. And that really prepared me for the business I'm in now, because we revolutionized the nonprofit fundraising direct response television world when we started doing the Shriners Hospitals for Children commercials. They're completely different than anything that's ever been done. And fortunately, I had a guy that I worked with who owns the company, and I just said, this is the way we need to go. And he's like, I don't think it'll work, but let's try it. And it's, I mean, now we're the gold standard in the industry and everybody's trying to copy us, you know, but we were the first.
Yeah.
And that, through that process of writing and hearing people's thoughts and critiques, I won't call it criticism because they were really critiques and they were all wanting to help me. I had to learn two things. One, don't take it personally, but the other, if you truly believe in something and believe it needs to be this way, then you just fight for it and you do it. And
what were some of those critiques that you can remember?
Oh,
you had it this way and this is how it ended up being differently.
Very specific in A Christmas Snow. And I still thank God that I went with my gut on it. At the end of the movie, Sam appears across the street. Kathy's looking out the window and she sees him. They make an eye connection. And in the script, he called her, I mean, as a kid, he called her Kate. As an adult, he called her Kathleen because he didn't want that connection. And he looks at her and they're so far away. She can't hear him, right? There's no way she could hear him. But he looks at her with his eyes and he says, Merry Christmas, Kate. And she says, Merry Christmas, Daddy. And a script writer that I know said, don't have that in there. It's cheesy. It'll take away from the story. Just have them look at each other and smile. And so I shot it both ways and I did an edit both ways. And my gut said, put it in there. And I can't tell you how many times I've had people say, when he says that, I'm bawling like a baby. I mean, it touches them because it's that connection back where she's, what she says is Merry Christmas, Daddy. But what she really says is I forgive you and I love you, you know, in her heart, you know.
Merry Christmas, Katie.
Merry Christmas, Daddy.
So that's a good example. And the person that gave me that critique was a formidable writer and, you know, said I was a fool if I would do that. And so I guess I'm a fool, but I'm glad I did it because it's pivotal. It's such a tender moment and it's so important in the end of the story.
Yeah. Know? So what was it like working with the cast?
Cast is great. Muse Watson, who was on NCIS, he played Mike Franks for years. He's very well known. And one of the reasons I cast him is because I'd seen him in other stuff. And he's such a great, he's a character actor. And he became Sam, right? And one thing that's interesting, like a little insight into behind the scenes, his nickname is One Take Muse Watson, because different actors work different ways. And that's one thing you have to learn as a director is, how do you work with your actors? Because not everybody works the same way. I mean, we're all different personalities. Mm-hmm. Muse is like, when he comes, his first take is his best take. And really? If you keep asking for more stuff, you can give him little things like do a little bit of this or do a little bit of that. But the performance actually goes down, I think goes down, because I think it starts to overthink it and do it. He's so in tune with his character and who his character is that when he comes to set, he drops that first line and he's got it. Okay. Wow. There are other actors I work with who you have to work your way up to. It's like, let's do it this way. Okay. Let's add a little bit of this. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Let's do that. And as they do rehearsals, every time we do a take, they get better and better and better to the point it's like, okay, we've really created a great scene here, but it takes rehearsal. So if you got somebody that's going, takes five or six shots, but one guy who's comes in is like one, and I'm not saying one is better than the other. To me, part of the process, so like working with Catherine Mary Stewart, who I was a fan of since high school because she was the last Starfighter, Night of the Comet, Weekend at Bernie's. I mean, she's done a little bit of everything, and she's done comedy, she's done drama. And I personally really enjoy an actress like her, because together she's like, what do you think of this? And I'm like, what do you think of that? And we start talking things through, and she runs it once and it's like, well, let's try this. And she's the type that builds up. So the more she does it, the better she gets. Right. And so I've got Muse on one side, who's like, he comes in, bang, he gives his best performance on his first take. And hers, we work into in about five or six takes in. Again, not a criticism at all. Honestly, to me, a process that I love, because it's discovery.
Yeah.
So how do you work with two actors who have a scene where you're shooting one side of that scene and
coming in at different levels?
Yeah. So I had to learn. I would give Muse, he would have his lines on a little postcard.
Yeah.
So we would shoot Kathy's side of it first. And I would just say, Muse, just read the lines to her. Don't act. Just read
them.
Yeah. And Kathy, thank God, she's such a good actress that she can handle that. Not all actors can handle that. So we would run through a scene. There's the one pivotal scene in the middle of the movie where he talks about leaving his family and how it killed him to do it, you know, and how he found Christ and how God set him free. And it's a beautiful, it's one of my favorite scenes. And on his side of the scene, it's this one long push in during his monologue. On her side of the scene, it's this face where she's watching him and she's listening to him. And she has this inner struggle because she has compassion for this man, but she still hates her father. And this guy that she's learned to all of a sudden like, she loses disrespect for in a second because he also left his family. And so she's mad at him for it. And she doesn't know how to, she struggles with that. And so we shot Kathy's side first, and I just wouldn't let Muse act. And then we turned the camera around and we shot Muse. And of course he just delivered. I'm bawling like a baby watching the monitor, you know, as he's given the scene. Cause he looks up and he creates and his eyes water and just one little tear comes down, you know, it's a broken man, you know, it was so beautiful. So that's a little bit behind the scenes stuff. And that's what you have to learn as a director is, how do you work with your talent in a way that you can help them garner the best performance possible? You know, that's my big payoff. When an actor and I work together and we both feel like that was amazing, where did that come from? That's like the biggest reward for me personally. Yeah. As a director.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What was it like working with Cameron?
Cameron Tenapel?
Yeah.
Lucy?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. So when we were casting the part of Lucy, I think I saw 250 girls. It was a bunch. Then I broke it down to one-on-one interviews, and I probably did about 30 one-on-ones. And it stood out. She was one that really stood out. And she, just because she was so natural at it, and you could throw stuff at her, you know, try it this way, try it that way, you know, you're this or that, this is your background, all that. And she just, she didn't need any directing, quite honestly. She was fantastic and the sweetest person you can meet. And her family was great. Her mom was on set with her pretty much the whole time. And I mean, we're friends to this day. I mean, they're just a great family. And it's funny because Cameron was the smartest person on set, you know, quite honestly. And she memorized everything. And typically in a movie set, you have the script supervisor who, like, if you forget a line or fudge a line a little bit, script supervisor will correct you. Well, we didn't need a script supervisor. We had Cameron. And it got to the point where even I, you know, the actors and myself were like, Cameron, what do we say here? What's the scene? And she's like, oh, this is where Kathy says blah, blah, blah. And this is where Mew says blah, blah, blah. Oh, okay, great. Yeah, okay, let's go. You know, and she had the whole script completely memorized. But I'll tell you the one story about her, which was amazing, is she's such a little fighter. And there was one scene, we were shooting and I could tell she wasn't feeling well. And I'm like, Cammy, all right, honey? And she's like, I don't feel good. So she went back to rest. We were shooting other parts of the scene and word got back to me that like, she's like sick, 100 yeah. and something odd degree temperature, throwing up, like sick. I'm like, oh, okay. Well, all right, we'll figure out what we're going to do. And so we were kind of just going to shut down that scene and work on something else. And it was late. It was probably like, I don't know, we were probably 8 or 9 hours in. And then all of a sudden, here comes the producer. He's like, hey, Cammy wants to do this. She doesn't want to let you down. I'm like, no, it's okay. She's sick. We'll be fine. We'll pick it up another time. So he sends him back. And then he comes back and he's like, dude, she's crying. She wants to do this. I'm like, so I went over there and I walked over and I talked to her mom's Debbie. I'm like, Debbie, I said, no pressure here. You don't have to. She's like, dude, I'm leaving up to her. She wants to do this. I'm like, Cam, are you sure, honey? She's like, yeah, because she felt like she would let everybody down, you know, and she didn't want to do that. So she came over, she hid her sickness in the scene, and you wouldn't know it. You know, if I told you she was sick during the scene, you wouldn't know it.
Yeah.
She acted it out, and then you could see, like, on the last scene, it's like, okay, and cut. You could see she went, oh, and then she's like, okay, now I'm sick again. You know, yeah. I mean, she was so strong for us.
Yeah.
So it was great.
And now, our feature presentation.
Don't look into the light.
Who are you? I'm terrified.
Don't be afraid. I am an angel.
A real angel?
Don't ask questions. I am here to announce a joyful event to you. To the world, actually. A child has been born in Bethlehem. He is the savior of the universe, Messiah. And master of the world. Look for a baby wrapped in a blanket, lying in a manger. Peace be to all and to all the good men.
Yay! Good job. Oh,
thank you.
Are there any Easter eggs you put into this film that as people watch it for the first time, as we just spoiled it, or if they go back and rewatch it,
yeah, the Easter egg. Well, my first film, Find Me, I put all kinds of them in. I'm a big fan of Ron Paul. So I put about 7 or 8 different Ron Paul things throughout the movie. And I actually got to meet him and hand him a copy of the movie and tell him to do it. And he watched and he loved it. But
that's awesome.
In Christmas Snow, well, actually, in all my films, the main big Easter egg is myself. I'm always the jogger in the movie. So if you see a guy jogging, that's me. And I always try and do something funny with it. And in Christmas Snow is hilarious because the scene is Catherine Mary Stewart. She is walking on the street and she turns and walks into her restaurant.
Yeah.
I'm just going to jog by. You know, I just jog by. Right. So they were shooting from across the street. So I walked over, I watched. I'm like, yeah, that looks great. I said, let's go one more time. I want to try something. Okay. So as she turns and goes into the restaurant, I run into a signpost, hit my face on the signpost, fall backwards and flip on the ground and just kind of lay in the middle of the street like I'm knocked out. Okay, well, I didn't tell anybody I was going to do that. And they're all like, oh my God, are you okay? Kathy comes out, oh my gosh, are you okay? You all right? I'm like, no, I did it on purpose. It was funny. So that's actually in the movie, that cut where I smacked the sign. And I got the idea for that. Do you remember that movie, While You Were Sleeping?
Yeah.
And it's like the next morning after something happened, and you see a kid riding his bike and he's throwing newspapers into the yards.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden his bike goes crazy and he flips and falls over. Completely unexpected. Had nothing to do with the story, but I remembered that. I thought, you know, I'm going to do stuff like that. So in The Lamp, I'm a jogger at the ball field and Jason London hits the ball big pop fly, and all the kids watch this ball go by. And as I'm jogging, it hits me on the head, and I get knocked down and fall down in the grass. Yeah. So I've just kind of done stuff like that just to be funny, you know?
The tragic jogger.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And my jogger name is Lars Umlaut. I don't have my name on there. Lars Umlaut. And Umlaut is the two dots over the U, right? Yes. That's an Umlaut song. I don't know why. Why do you do these goofy things? But we did it. It was fun.
So what do you think really is why this movie seems to resonate with people and why it was so popular?
I can tell you why. I think we all have a story like that, or we know somebody like that. We all have baggage in our lives. We all have things that happen to us in our lives. And the thing, the story of restoration in A Christmas Snow is such a powerful story. I mean, it's really the gospel story if you think about it. You know, once I was lost, now I am found, and I found a new way of thinking or a new way of seeing life, and I'm willing to let go and forgive. And through that forgiveness comes restoration, and through that restoration becomes a freedom and a peace. I think that everybody wants or would hope to expect to get, and they experience it. We did, after the movie was done, we had the opportunity to create the movie, turn it into a play, and we were in Branson for two seasons. What was really cool about that, so the first year, Catherine Mary and Muse and Cameron were all, so the three main characters from the movie were actually did the stage play together, which was like a family reunion, quite honestly. It was, really? It was so great. Yeah. Because really? They're just great people. Like I say, I'm friends with all of them now, you know, we're going on 10 years ago, 11 years ago. But what I saw in the theaters that was amazing to me was people watching, and you could always tell, and it's the scene where Kathleen gets the box and she realizes this box has been on her front door the whole time. Sam is gone. She can't find him. She gets the box, and then through the contents, the watch, the Bible, all the different things in the box, you realize, and it's the letter comes from a lawyer who's telling her, your father's passed away and here are his belongings that he wanted you to have. And there's a letter in there, which is from Sam. And all of a sudden it just goes click. Oh my God, that was Sam, right? How could that be? He's dead. But the letter says he died 2 weeks ago, but he was in my house, you know? So there's all this stuff where the audience is going, what, what? And I could always see people like turning and talking to each other. Wait a second, Sam's your dad? I thought he's dead. How could he be dead? You know, and they start doing that. But then she goes to this box and sees these things. It's a very emotional scene. And the amazing thing, Catherine Mary Stewart, I mean, every night, we did 77 shows, I think, the first season. Mm-hmm. Every night, she worked up that emotion and delivered that scene. It was so amazing. I was just so proud of her and what she did with that. And but anyhow, so people would see this play. And because I would get up and do like the welcome and the greeting and all that, so they knew I was the director, right? And so I would hang out toward the back. So I actually, during the, we didn't have a huge budget, so I was running sound during the play, you know? So I was in the back of the room. But people would stop and just, honestly, they would grab me and they would hug me and they would weep, you know? And they're like, you don't know. You don't know what I've dealt with. And I've got my father, I'm estranged from my kids, you know, all these different things. And they would start just sharing their stories. I mean, I'd cry every night, you know, after the sneak and play, you know, because of that. And one great story, we went to the Chamber of Commerce to meet with them in Branson. We took the cast and we were just promoting the deal. And this guy comes up, and I would guess he was in his mid 70s. And he said, my wife and I went and saw your play the other night, and he said it broke us, and we went home, we went and bought the books and the movies. He said, we've been estranged from our kids for 15 years. We have two sons and we haven't seen them in 15 years, and we wrote them a letter and we sent them the stuff and we asked them to forgive us. So they said they're coming to Branson to reconnect. 15 years.
Wow.
So that's why you tell stories.
And when the time came for Mary and Joseph to present the child to the Lord, they took baby Jesus to the temple. In Jerusalem, at the very same time, there was a man, Simeon by name, a good man, and God's Spirit was upon him. And God revealed to him that he would see the Messiah before he died. Led by the Spirit, Simeon went to the temple, just as the parents of Jesus brought the child to be presented before God. And Simeon, seeing the baby, took him into his arms, and he blessed God, saying, God, you can release your servant. Release me in peace, as you have promised. With my own eyes, I have seen your salvation, and now it's in the open for all to see. A light for all the world.
That stuff was amazing, and that play was amazing, because there was probably 100 stories like that that I experienced while we were there.
How long did it run? Yeah.
2 seasons. So November through December, 2 years, 11 and 12, I think it was. Anyhow, I'd love to bring it back, honestly. It's such a great story. I've saved all the sets. I still have them sitting in a warehouse.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I'd love to rebuild that.
Well, let's hope that this can get done, especially now post-COVID.
Yeah. Well, live performances have an energy to them, you know, and the actors love it. I love it, just sitting there watching it every night. I mean, we did 77 shows in a month and a half, and you ate it up, man. You loved it.
Yeah.
I did. They did. Yeah. It's tiring. I mean, you're shot by the end of the run, but it's fantastic.
So how did you get into film?
Well, I mean, as a high schooler, I was shooting stuff on, back then we had 8mm,
yeah,
you know, and just making things, and didn't think, you know, one day I'll be a filmmaker. It was just, I like telling stories. I don't know what it is. I like creating things and getting in front of people and getting people's reactions from it. And then in college, I got into television and live broadcasts. And then post school, college, I went on the road with music acts and did, you know, stage design, lighting design, and, you know, ran shows. And then I got married, so that kind of ended the road life, but it was always in me. So then when I had a marketing company that started doing really well, so I could invest into doing these things. And so that's how we kind of started. But it's my heartbeat. I had a friend who's an evangelist, and he was on stage the other night. I was watching him. I said, man, that's your happy place, isn't it? And he said, this is where life makes sense to me. And I was like, you know what? That's what it is for me when I'm on set. When I'm on set, working with my crew and working with my actors, together we're building this crazy thing that somehow comes together and tells a story. That's where life makes sense to me, honestly. Mm. I love it.
Ho, 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 Merry Christmas.
It's a Christmas tree.
It looks more like a bush.
It's a Christmas bush.
Okay, come on.
Any upcoming projects that you're excited about?
Oh, yeah,
I've
got projects. Gosh, I've been writing. I've got, I don't know, 6 or 7 scripts that are pretty much ready to go. I've got some TV shows I'm working on. I've got another movie I'm working on. So my this age in my life, I'm in my mid-50s, and I'm like, okay, yeah, I got 20 more years of doing stuff. Yeah, 15 maybe, we'll see. But, you know, I want to get back into long-form narrative, because it's just, it's my life's blood, man.
Yeah. What are some films that have influenced you over the years that you can pinpoint?
Find Me, Christmas like? Snow, The Lamp. That's an interesting question, because people always say, what's your favorite movie? And I like different movies for different reasons. There's one, I don't know what year it was made, I'm guessing mid-70s, Robert Redford's in it, Faye Dunaway. It's called 3 Days with Condor. And it's a good old-fashioned spook spy film back when, you know, Cold War stuff. And it's just so well written and so well acted that I just enjoy it. A recent one that I think is probably one of the best crafted films I've seen in a long time is Molly's Game. Aaron Sorkin wrote it and directed it. He's probably one of the best writers to ever live, quite honestly. And he's a great director too, evidently. But that one, just the way that, and he does a lot of narrative in it where the actor is narrating what's happened, you know, and that's usually not something I like in a film, but he does it in such a way that you, I don't know, you just dig it. And the life lesson that comes out of that too is really good, you know, about integrity. Even if you're doing something legal, at least she's integritous. And the father, even though he screwed up, they reconciled, you know.
Has the way in which he did that narrative the narration.
Mm-hmm.
Has that kind of shifted your perspective on some of your projects, thinking maybe I could do this?
No, I would say no.
Okay.
No. But he just did such a good job with it. You know, there's not a lot of those that are out there that are really great, you know. And of course, just for fun, I love Guardians of the Galaxy and things like that, you know, because they're just fun. But I don't have a favorite film. I'm just trying to think if there's something that, you know, different ones stick out for different reasons. But those are the first two that kind of really come to mind. Yeah. They're always good go-tos. I don't watch movies more than once in most cases. But Molly's Game, I've probably seen three or four times. And I've recommended it to a lot of people. 3 Days of the Condor, I've seen a dozen times. You know, there's a lot. There's so many good ones out there. It's just, it's hard to really nail it down.
Now, at the beginning of the episode, we were talking about the neuroscience and mm-hmm. those triggers. In the last episode that we recorded with you, you talked about changing your mind, being able to, you know, figure out what those triggers are and then start to change your mind. Talk about that.
Renewing your mind. Yeah. I mean, that's a Bible verse, Romans 12:2, you know, do not be conformed. I mean, depending on the translation, but do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. And it's a life verse. I tattooed it on my arm. I've got it here, you know, because I don't ever want to forget it, you know. And the thing that you have to get to understand is that your life as you have it today is a result of your belief systems. And those belief systems drive the choices and decisions that you make, which are actually the triggers that you have. And you can renew your mind. And when I say renew it, is through repetition, is through input. And through that, so, I mean, the Bible's very clear. Faith comes by hearing and hearing again and again. You know, it's like putting things in your head over and over, because you're putting stuff in your mind all the time. But what is it? Is your main consumption the news? Is your main consumption horror films? Or, you know, I mean, what is it that you put in? Or are you putting positive things in your mind? And you got to get that, the new habits. And so when you actually learn something new, your brain actually writes new synapses, new pathways, and you can actually over time completely renew your mind, become a completely different person. And it's all by changing belief systems. And most people live their lives being a victim of circumstance. Most people say, you know, I want this, but the opportunity hasn't presented itself. Well, guess what? No opportunity will present itself. You have to go out there and get it. And what people don't realize is you will see what you look for. You will notice what you focus on. And a great example, what's the most recent car you've purchased?
A 2019 Jeep Cherokee Trailhawk.
Right. So when you bought that 2019 Jeep Cherokee, did you start seeing them everywhere?
I had been seeing Jeeps everywhere for years because I wanted a Jeep deep down.
Because you wanted one, yeah. And so what you don't realize is there's a part of our brain called the reticular activating system. It's in the back of our head. And that is the thing that determines what you are going to focus on, because there's so much information coming in all the time.
Yeah.
Your body and your brain can only process so much of it, right? So it says, what is it that you want? And I will reinforce that. Some people call it the law of attraction. I call it the law of attention, because what you pay attention to is what you will see. And people will say, oh, these opportunities just came up. No, they're there because you're focused on those. And that's where you're heading in your life. So your brain will look to reinforce to you what you want and will pay attention to those things and ignore other things. You know, it's like right now you're sitting here talking to me and you don't feel your pants on your legs, but now you do because I brought attention to it and you're noticing it, and the socks and the shoes on your feet. Okay, that's information your body doesn't need. So you actually do not feel it. Those neural receptors are turned off.
Yeah.
But when I say it to you, your brain goes, oh, that's something you got to pay attention to. Oh, wait, now I feel the cloth on my legs and my shoes feel actually kind of warm. The temperature's kind of hot. But before I said that, you didn't notice it. So all that to say is what you are putting in your brain on a regular basis is what you're going to focus on and is what you're going to see. I think that's a big part of the problem we have with our political system right now, that each side is focusing on certain things so much, it's all they see, and they're not seeing the other perspective. They're not seeing the other side. There is right and wrong on both sides. There's not one side that's all right and one side that's all wrong. But because we so reinforce the messages by the things we take in on a regular basis, that's all we see. And then our brain will go, well, there it is again. See, I'm right. It reinforces that. See, you're right. And being right is safe. Your brain will want to keep you safe. We're built to keep alive. Even though safe may be what's wrong for you, your brain will always bring you back to safe. And safe could be, I mean, statistically, if you look it up, people who grew up in abusive relationships, most of the time will end up entering an abusive relationship. And you think, why would they do that? They were raised in an abusive relationship. Why would they get into one as an adult? Not that it's good for them, but it's safe. It's what they know. And we will self-sabotage ourselves to keep ourselves safe. So if your belief system is set on things that are safe that are bad for you, and people who take drugs are that way, they use that as an escape. You get that dopamine hit, you get that endorphin release, you know? Though that is the thing that is killing you, it's what you run to because it's what you know. And your brain says, we have to stay safe, right? It's like the herd mentality. It's like when if you're outside the herd, that's dangerous. But if you're in the middle of the herd, even though that herd may be running off a cliff, hey, but everybody else is doing it, so I'm safe, right? And so decisions can be made sometimes that actually are destructive to you, and many times by what we're taking in on a regular basis. So what are you taking in and what are you focusing on? So if you don't like where your life is at this moment, measure what your intake is, look for it, and then choose the things that you want. Choose the people that you want to be like. Many times, I think you've heard that saying, you know, you're the average of the five closest people that you hang around with. You know, you're never
the five people you spend the most time with.
Yeah, you're never going to make more money than them or live any greater than they do because you find that it's a safety. And so if it sounds bad, but if there are friends that you don't, people that you're friends with that actually aren't really good for you, then you got to find some new friends. But growth only comes through discomfort. Muscle building only comes through tearing down muscle. You know, victory only comes on the other side of a battle. You know, growth is pain. And if you're going to run away from pain, then you'll never grow. So you always embrace the pain and learn and grow from it.
That's good.
And that
stuff
can be physical pain as well as emotional pain. Yeah.
So practically speaking, if someone came to you and said, Tracy, I just can't seem to kick alcohol. Tracy, I'm in all these bad relationships. How would you coach them for getting that stuff changed?
So alcoholism, bad relationships are a result. They are not the cause. They're an outward expression of an inward belief. And I would say, let's look at what your identity is. And many people don't know what their identity is, you know? So who do you believe you are? You will become who you believe you are. And if you believe you need a vice, that you're not strong enough on your own, that you aren't worthy, you know, whatever it is, you will always run to these things. Because again, your brain is saying that's a safety, it's a harbor, go there. And your brain will give you a hit of dopamine to reward you. You know, so our brains are just trying to keep us safe. We determine what safe is. And if you haven't determined it, if you haven't measured it and said, okay, what do I believe is a safe place in my life? Is it an abusive relationship? Is it this job? Is it what I believe about myself, you know? Or is it, you know, who am I in Christ? You know, what is my identity? And if you can't, how can I say it? It's coming to realize, especially if you're a Christian, even if you're not a Christian, is identifying yourself. When I say in Christ, what I mean is, what does the Bible say who you are? Right? Fearfully and wonderfully made, unique, that you are loved by your God, you know, that you, the Holy Spirit can guide you, that you have value, you know. And the Bible, sadly, in most cases, most people see the Bible as a list of rules and regulations that they want to buck up against because, I mean, we are selfish and narcissistic by nature. But if you can look at it and see what it truly is, I see it as more of a love letter from a God to a creation than anything else. If we can embrace that and see who we are, like I say, in Christ, these things, alcohol, I mean, I drink all the alcohol I want to drink. I just don't need it. So I don't drink it. You know, I take all the drugs I want to take. I don't want it. So I don't take any, you know, it's not like I, you know, like some people say, well, you don't understand. I have an addictive personality. I'm sure you do, but you get to determine what you're addicted to, you know? And it's again, identity. Who are you? What do you believe about yourself? So that was the thing I would do, is go back to finding out who do they believe they are, number one, and where did that belief come from? And I would guess, highly educated guess, that it's something that you experience from the age of 0 to 7. when your brain is in theta wave, it's in that low bandwidth wave, and you're writing files on your hard drive. And then again, as we get older, all we do is access files. Yeah. So what happened to you then that formed your belief system? And then what are you doing today to rewrite the files that you don't want to have in your head?
That's wonderful. Yeah.
Does that answer your question?
Yes.
I tend to talk. I can run on.
Which is good for a podcast because...
Well, it helps you.
If I'm the host and I'm doing all the talking, there's a problem. So.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, but I need you to help carry this load, right?
So Tracy Trost, thanks for being on the Exploration Films podcast again.
My pleasure. Honestly, I love it. And I'm going to give a shout out to the Exploration Boys because they do a great job. I love those guys.
Yeah. You mentioned that on the last one, how impactful being with Exploration has been for the distribution of your films.
Oh, yeah. I resurrected my films for in some ways, you know. The TV stuff I had good relationships with, and it was out a lot on TV, but they introduced it to a whole nother audience in the streaming side, you know. And I mean, people are still watching the films. People are still being changed. I still get emails. It's amazing how people can find you. That's kind of scary. Facebook, of course, but I get emails right to my personal email. I'm like, how did you find this? You know, it's like, okay, you know. But the letters, I love the letters, quite honestly, because most of the time, I mean, I get some who tell me, you know, you should do something different or this is no good. But most of the time, it's about how their life was touched or changed through the films.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
How do people follow you? How do people learn more about what you're doing? And
I say, oh boy, because I'm not great at that stuff. You know, Facebook's the best way. Tracy J. Trost, that's the best way to find me. I'm actually working on a website right now because, you know, when I work with new people, the first thing, I look you up on the web. I don't see a lot about you. I'm like, yeah, because I don't do that stuff. You know, I need to hire someone to market me. I know, I'm writing stories, you know. I'm having a good time doing that, but just Facebook is the best.
We look forward to your next projects. Thanks for being on, Tracy.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Exploration Films podcast. To check out this film, you can go to our new streaming service at exploreflix.world. Exploration Films has long been a pioneer and leader in the faith and family film space. And that's why we're so excited to tell you that we've finally launched our own streaming service, exploreflix.world. If you or your family are looking for amazing films, compelling documentaries, unique stories, concerts, and Christian growth resources that all support your Christian worldview, then check out exploreflix.world and get 7 days free. You can go to exploreflix.world. One other quick note, if you like what you hear, please be sure to click subscribe on this podcast app so you'll never miss an episode. For the entire Exploration Films team, I'm Steve Ryder. Thank you for investing your time with us.
That's a wrap.